Yes, my announcement was an error. The next case is Bell against the United States. Mr. Allman, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Chief Justice, may it please the Court. It is my position here in the interpretation of the federal bank robbery statute that Section 2113B does not cover the crime of false pretenses. Here, as the facts indicated in the brief, a client managed to take some money from Dayton Federal Savings and Loan by and with their consent by an artifice or trick. That is, he altered a check, which should have been obvious had they looked at it, and took $10,000 from this account, which he created in his own name. The check was not drawn to him. It was done totally by mistake on behalf of the bank. Basically, what we have,
Mr. Allman, Daytona wasn't the drawee of the check either, was it?
No, it was a Dade Federal Savings and Loan. It was a check that he somehow came into possession of, altered the deposit number on the back, i.e., put his account number after scratching out somebody else's, and put it in an account that he created in Dade Federal Savings and Loan.
And the check wasn't drawn on Dade Federal
Savings? No, it was not. It was drawn to somebody else for deposit to some account of the person whose check it was. Basically, he got the bank involved through the bank's mistake. It is my position in reading the statute, and it's created an ambiguity. It has got the courts of appeals, I think it's 5-4 now, construing the statute both narrowly and broadly. The statute, the bank robbery statute, which in 1934 was specifically limited to bank robbery, amended in 1937 to include the terms burglary and larceny, and in 1937 interpreted and argued by the government that, in fact, this covered only common law larceny, to the position now where the circuit, the Fifth Circuit, former Fifth Circuit, now the 11th, first went along with my arguments in my brief, then in bank reversed itself and took the broad position that 2113B covered the crime of false pretense. The reason all this has come about is the way this Congress drew the statute. The statute was drawn as follows. It indicated that you take and carry away, steal, or purloin, words that are not necessarily defined specifically at common law, but are in fact defined now, generically, but in 1934 and 1937, were contemplated in the common law sense. What has happened is this. In 1934, a broad bank robbery statute in bill form was submitted to the House Judiciary Committee. The committee had considered this bill and specifically rejected the aspect of the bill that covered crimes of false pretense, embezzlement, and other crimes by trick or consensual takings, and restricted it to the forceful robbery concept. Thus, the title of the act, the text of the bill, and the thrust of the situation in 1934 with the gangster-style bank robberies going on. Subsequently, apparently, in briefly reading the act, the prosecutors have brought prosecutions of people who take money from banks in various types of ways, false checks, forgeries, false pretenses, trick, deceit, fraud, etc. Four districts have gone along with this. Four districts have not. However, the Supreme Court itself in Jerome in 1943 took the position, and the government took the position, that the Bank Robbery Act, 2113B, was a common law situation, defining the crimes it intended to prescribe as robbery, burglary, and larceny, even though the Act eventually uses the terms steal, purloin, take, and carry away, which are not specific to those crimes. In Turley, the Supreme Court gave us some indications how we should interpret these nonspecific common law terms. What they have said is this. You look to the legislative history of the Act. In this case, specifically, in the Masters, the Ninth Circuit looked at the legislative history in great detail, quoted directly from it, saying they could not do better than the analysis which they put forth of the legislative history, which showed specifically the Act originally was intended to be broad. It was tightened and limited to robbery in 1934 and then extended to burglary and common law larceny only in 1937. For this reason, the factual situation that Mr. Bell put himself in unwittingly exempted him from prosecution under 2113B. In the dissent in the 11th Circuit, the judge said, it is no question about it, Mr. Bell has committed some kind of a crime. However, the crime he committed is not contemplated in 2113B because the legislative history, combined with the title to the Act, combined with the fact that the Act contemplated a, shall we say, active or violent taking away from robbery, burglary, some kind of active, moving type of crime, as opposed to the act of crime of false pretense, that is, something stealthily done. It is our position, if you follow Turley and the appellate courts that look at Turley carefully and analyze the guidelines in Turley and apply them to the act in this case, including the context of the act, that is robbery, violent acts, taking away, carrying away, that type of thing, with the fact that they were specifically in the bill, in the House investigation of what they should do about the robbery situations occurring in the 30s, took and eliminated the crime of false pretenses from the purview of this act. And it's my conclusion, and I think the only conclusion that is reasonable if you take the act and interpret the ambiguities in it in accordance with what's happened legislatively.
So you agree you must resort to legislative history to win your case?
Yes, I do, Judge. And I think in the Ninth Circuit, the Masters analyzed legislative histories of 2113B, even though Turley was a...
What is that? What is the ambiguity in the statute? Do you think it's what meaning you give to steal?
Steal and purloin. Yes, sir.
Because there was a carrying away of money with some kind of an intent to at least the person knew he wasn't entitled to the money.
There's no question about that, Judge. He committed a crime, probably a state crime involving the generic term he stole. He took somebody else's
property.
But
Jerome at least used words that had some common law meaning, like larceny. Things like that. But steal or purloin doesn't have that kind of meaning.
It's a generic term, that is correct, and that creates the ambiguity in this sense. If you look at the history of the law, if they intended to cover that type of crime, they would not have eliminated specifically the crime of false pretenses as they did in the legislative debates that created the robbery statute. They wanted to leave the states with that type of crime, specifically focusing the federal law on the crime involving robbery, active carrying away, the violent gangster-type crime that initiated this situation. That's my analysis of that ambiguity situation, Judge. In Turley, where they were interpreting the Dyer Act of the Interstate Transportation of stolen Motor Vehicles, that type of thing, stolen was construed consistently with legislative history to be a broad thing where the federal government had an interest in controlling interstate transportation of stolen vehicles. In this case, it's the exact opposite. The Congress specifically eliminated the crime of false pretenses in its debate before creating the statute. That is found. It's analyzed, I think, very well in LeMaster's, the Ninth Circuit decision, which is consistent with the other four decisions in applying Turley to the word stolen in the context of the statute along with the legislative history. The only conclusion I think you can come to reasonably, if you look at LeMasters and go along with Turley, is that 2113B was a restrictive statute, and the government used to argue in 1937 that, in fact, it was a restrictive statute.
Are there any other statutes that would make it a crime to get money from a bank other than by this violent kind of a crime?
Yes, there are, Judge. I believe every state in the union has a generic term, which
any other federal law, any federal law?
Yes. As a matter of fact, a recent case, Williams case in Sterling, it's 1025, indicates that, and this court held recently, I think it was 1982, that unless the Congress specifically says in so many words that this is the prescribed act, we will not expand the congressional intent to cover a generic type situation. In analyzing the legislative history in Williams, this is exactly what they did. The government was seeking to place a broad concept on the words used in the statute, where Congress in its legislative history did not intend the same.
Well, I'll put it another way. Does this act go as far as any act towards covering false pretenses kinds of crime, or are there some other statutes that might reach false pretenses?
There are other statutes, both state and federal, I believe.
I mean federal.
Okay.
Does this come as close as any?
I believe this comes about as close as any. There are other statutes that cover, for instance, the card sharping statute, which specifically contemplated false pretenses by specific language, which I cite in my brief. I can't recall the case name at this time. However, in that case, the Congress specifically said card sharping and false pretenses is a federal crime on the high seas. It was something to do with gambling off the shore of New Jersey or something like that, specifically enumerated by Congress. This is the reverse. In this case, Congress specifically contemplated a broad bank robbery statute in the House bill and rejected it.
Well, do some of the cases on either side of this issue, do some of them relate to, giving a bank false information in an application for a loan and getting money from...
Yes, so that's Williams. That was decided in 1982. That's the one.
Well, couldn't this defendant perhaps have been charged under that section, 1014?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Reading that, it's a false statement or a report to get money. It's probably inducing a bank to lend you money by false statement or some other misrepresentation. That's the way I read Section 18 U.S.C. 1014.
Well, he certainly got money by means of false statements here.
Well, in reality, he took advantage of the bank's mistake. He basically forged the check, eliminated the back deposit number, put his number and name on it, and deposited it. The bank did look at the check and paid him the money. The false statement, I guess, he induced the bank by trick or fraud to give him somebody else's money. It's what he did. There's no question about it. He committed a crime. The only problem is the crime was not 2113B.
Have the liabilities been settled as between the Dade Federal Savings and whatever bank the check was drawn upon in this case?
I am not certain about that, but I am certain that Dade Federal guaranteed his endorsement, and therefore they ultimately would have had paid for their mistake, I'm sure. It's an interesting footnote that the money this man got by this means was taken from him in a burglary, apparently. But that's immaterial, I guess.
Congress, in 1014, Congress has protected the bank against false statements and loan applications?
Yes, sir.
So it really hasn't left to the states in all circumstances the false pretenses crimes, all of them.
I would agree with that 100%, yes, sir.
Well, here's just another, arguably it didn't leave the false pretenses kind of crime involved in this case to.
I would have no problem with that in resolving ambiguity in saying stolen or purloined if the legislative history had not specifically eliminated the crime of false pretenses. In LeMasters, in Jerome, if you look at the LeMasters case, the House Judiciary Committee had a very broad bill They accepted one provision and eliminated two others. Specifically, Section 2 said it should be a crime for anybody to trick a bank in any way, shape, or form, false pretenses or whatever, and accomplish the taking of money from said bank. This was not enacted in the statute. It was contemplated and eliminated specifically in 2113B. And that is why I think it's different. I think it would be a good result had they left it in, but they didn't. And that's my problem with 2113B and this prosecution.
What would he have been charged with under state law? Would you suppose forgery? Or
not? Larceny. Straight larceny.
I know, but how about, did he forge somebody? He forged somebody's name, didn't he?
Forgery is given a very broad definition in Florida. If you do something that alters something to your
benefit. Well, he purported to be the payee, didn't he?
Yes, he removed 40 deposit only to some account number. He scratched that out. 40 deposit only, me, my account number. That's exactly what he did. The bank chose to ignore the fact that he scratched up the prior limited endorsement. And they guaranteed his endorsement, and that was the bank's mistake. But that is not a crime under 2113B, and that is the whole problem here. It should be, but it's not. The Congress chose to eliminate that specifically in the legislative history.
But
and
Mr.
that's the
Allman,
problem.
Isn't there an aspect of the legislative history that you haven't addressed, at least yet? In the 34 bill, they broke it into two parts, consensual takings and non-consensual takings.
Judges,
and it was with the consent of the bank that the artifice and trick language appeared. But in the 37 bill, there's no division between consensual and non-consensual, from which one might infer, I'm not sure this is right, that the statute was intended to cover both categories. And once it covers both categories, you don't need the artifice language, because takes and carries away is enough to take care of it.
You can argue that, Judge, but when Congress had done something specifically and not later taking corrective action, as they have done in other cases.
They did take out the words without the consent of the bank, which was also in the 34 bank, the bill.
The bill, which was not enacted.
Correct, which was it. Which that bill said without the consent of the bank was one of the two alternatives. But that language isn't in the 37 Act.
That is correct. Now, if you look at the 37 Act, the Attorney General said, look, we've got a robbery statute, but if there's nobody around, the guy comes in and takes the money off the counter and walks out, we don't have a robbery. We can't prosecute him under our Bank Robbery Act. Therefore, we should change the act as follows. Make it burglary. You don't have to put anybody in fear to take the money. And larceny, common law larceny. At that time, the government argued, yes, the definition is common law larceny.
But if they wanted just to cover that situation, should they not have said takes and carries away without the consent of the bank? Because in that situation, there would have been no consent.
That's
the one
correct.
That they're talking about specifically, somebody came in and found the money on
takes
the counter.
Takes and carries away, steals or purloins.
Yeah.
That is an inaccurate common law larceny definition, basically. It's a little broader than that. I agree with you.
You're suggesting the statute should be read as if it included the words without the consent of the bank.
If we're going to separate the false pretenses gets us to the fact that they tricked them. The bank gave consent to take it, yes.
Yeah.
With the larceny situation, and I think as the statute reads and as Congress intended, it contemplated a active, violent robbery, burglary concept, coming in and taking something, not coming in, talking to the teller, putting a check in, going back, waiting on 21-day period, and then withdrawing the money at their leisure. Taking a chance that the bank would not detect this. This is not common law larceny. This is false pretenses. LeMaster specifically addressed this issue and said the statute doesn't cover it.
Well, Mr. Allman,
yes, sir.
Wasn't the common law element of aspartation in larceny, wasn't that just taking and carrying away, requiring a removal right then, so to speak?
Well, this is the way I feel, and this is what I think Congress was concerned with. They were concerned with, I think, the violent aspect, taking and carrying away, the robbery concept. This is the Federal Bank Robbery Act. 2113B is, I think, a lessening of the requirement for violence,
but
requiring still the non-consensual taking away.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be robbery. It could be burglary.
Burglary or larceny. But it's the quick, violent, active type of crime that Congress was addressing in this matter. If you look at legislative history, and if you look at the interpretation in Turley says How are we going to interpret the word steal and purloin? Purloin could mean by stealth, but it's still the same concept. All the tellers go to the coffee machine. He comes in, sees the money on the table, picks it up, and walks out. That's a larceny. Like you say, there's no consent from the bank. In this case, the bank helped him commit this crime by mistake. He tricked the bank just as though he tricked the people who had the money. That's why in Congress, in limiting itself to the violent type of crime, specifically said, we do not want to cover the crime of false pretenses by eliminating Section 2 in the 1934 bill. And again, in 1937, not specifically enacting it.
When you say violent, I take it that,
I mean active.
A burglary could certainly obtain at 3 in the morning,
sure,
and no guards around. There would be no violence, but there would be an immediate removal.
Non-consensual, active taking away. Yes, sir. And that's my problem with this statute applying to this case.
Why is this less a removal than taking it at 3 o'clock in the morning when they happen to leave the door open?
It's both a removal. There's no question about it. It's a crime. The difference is this.
He carries it away in both cases, does he not?
I'm sorry, sir?
He carries it away in both cases.
Yes, he carries it away.
In the statute.
There's no question about it. The difference is, in this case, Congress considered the option of covering consensual trickery or crimes by the bank coming in and being suckered into a deal. They considered that. They specifically eliminated it in 1934. If they had intended, and if it had been a problem, as the burglary and larceny aspects, the original statute was inadequate to cover the immediate taking and non-consensual carrying away type thing. So in 37, they amended it. They changed it. But they did not go back to Section 2, which they eliminated in 1934, and say this shall include, by implication and interpretation, the trick, the false pretense. False pretense was not larceny, ever, under any definition in common law. False pretense was a separate crime, primarily because they got possession and title, and the old larceny thing, they got possession with the consent. In this case, the bank intended him to have the money. They thought it was his money. They had made a mistake. He had involved the bank in a crime, but not the crime under 2113B, because there was no non-consensual taking away. There was a consensual tricking of the bank, not covered by the statute. The legislative history is specific on that. They could have put it in. They did not. In Williams, this court, absent support in legislative history for the design of the statute to apply to the specific conduct, does this court, the Supreme Court, holds that it is not prescribed. That is not the conduct approached in this statute. That was the conclusion in Williams in 18 U.S.C. 1014. We have an analogous situation. Just recently, the Supreme Court again said, consistent with the approach of lenity, or the construction of the criminal statute shall be specific. They shall not be presumed to take over the state's role in prosecuting crimes. The federal bankruptcy statute approaches and addresses itself specifically, according to legislative history, the non-consensual, violent, or active taking away from a bank, not false pretenses, which was contemplated and rejected. That's my whole problem with 2113B in this case.
Am I correct that if you win, your man goes free, and that the statute is run on the state case? Am I right?
No, sir. The statute is not run on the state case. And I think ultimately that's what the courts are doing. They're making sure that somebody who does something that's wrong is punished. And I think what is happening is they're stretching the statutes too far, when the congressional intent was specific not to stretch it to this crime. It's, I think, what really happened, and basically what we're talking about, is the prosecutor charged him with the wrong statute. He could have turned it over to the state. The man would have been punished. He made a mistake. In the dissent, they admit he committed a crime. He did something wrong. There was no question about that. The problem is he going to be punished, or are we going to let him go because he was charged with the wrong statute? And unfortunately, under the law, a few guilty men must escape so that the law maintains its integrity. I have reserved some time for rebuttal, if I might.
We'll resume at 1 o'clock.
Thank you.
Mr. Giuliani.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The petitioner in this case obtained possession of a $10,000 check that did not belong to him to be deposited into a savings account at the Dade County Savings and Loan Association. Petitioner opened an account at the Dade County Bank using a false address, birth date, and Social Security number. He then deposited the stolen check into this new account at another branch of the Dade Bank using a second false address and having altered the account number on the check to state his own new account number. After a 20-day holding period, the petitioner withdrew $10,000 plus interest from this account. In plain everyday English, petitioner stole $10,000 plus interest that at the time belonged to the Dade County Bank, a bank insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The bank theft statute, 18 United States Code, section 2113B, prohibits anyone from taking and carrying away with intent to steal or purloin money belonging to a bank insured by the FDIC.
Mr. Giuliani, did he take cash?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe he did. In plain English, that is precisely what petitioner did. He stole $10,000. In order to avoid the express language of this prohibition, petitioner urges that the words do not mean what they say, but instead should be read to mean that Congress in 1937 meant to prohibit solely larceny at common law, that is, trespassory taking or taking without consent.
Was there any other federal statute which conceivably could have covered his action here?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Not 1014.
1014 would not, because this would, under your own decision in 1014, this would not have amounted to an extension of credit.
The Court's decision.
Yes, Your Honor. Crucial to the crime of larceny at common law was a trespass, really a physical invasion, because primitive criminal law was concerned only with protection against force or violence. A trespass was necessary for any crime to be felonious. As the criminal law developed, however, and expanded to protect other interests, including property, rather than acknowledging the changing nature of the law, the courts in England engaged in fictions to avoid the reality of reversing prior precedents. So crimes such as larceny by trick and unilateral mistake developed, so that it was larceny to trick someone out of possession of that money, but it would not constitute larceny if the owner of the money had also turned over titles. If petitioner's argument is accepted and that these ancient distinctions are revived, it would be a violation of Section 2113B if a person cashing a check for $100 mistakenly received $1,000 from the teller, realized that mistake, and decided to keep it and walked out of the bank, because that, at common law, would have amounted to larceny by trick. In the sense that, according to the fiction, only possession had been turned over, not title.
That would have been a violation of state law?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
That would be a violation of state law, I assume.
I assume it would be.
Just in a broader sense, what is the reason why these cases ought to be in the federal court rather than the state court?
Well, Your Honor, the bank.
I understand it's a federal insurance at a bank, but nevertheless, it is a state crime as well, just in terms of allocating law enforcement resources. Why wouldn't this be a good category to leave to the states?
Well, first of all, there is potential federal liability in the sense of all of these banks are insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
I understand.
And it's our view that this is precisely.
Well, I'm not too sure that the statute doesn't limit it to those. It says any bank. The statute says any bank. Those insured or not, wouldn't it?
No, Your Honor. It would have to be either
all banks insured?
I don't believe all banks are insured, Your Honor. It would have
to
be.
Well, the statute says all banks, doesn't it?
Well, it should be. It is.
Of any bank, credit union, or any savings and loan association. So it applies to all banks.
Well, it now does. At the time that this amendment was passed in 1937, it was passed specifically to apply to banks that were insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
But the statute we are operating under says all banks.
It's been expanded since then. That's correct.
It says all. That's the one we operate in.
That's correct.
I joined my
Brother Stevens, I don't see what the federal government's interest is in any bank.
When
an uninsured bank, what interest would the federal government have in stealing money from an federally uninsured bank?
First of all, Your Honor, this particular bank was not an uninsured bank. This bank was insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The statute that we're construing here was passed in order to protect the assets of federally insured banks. And that is one of the reasons why we argue for an interpretation that would include all forms
of theft. But isn't it true it was passed in response to a specific problem? John Dillinger and some of his friends were running around the country crossing state lines, holding up banks all over the place. Wasn't that what caused this statute to be enacted?
No, Your Honor. That is what caused the 1934
right.
Act
And then
to pass.
They picked it up to take care of the fellow who walks in and finds the money on the counter.
Well, but I think there's a very big difference between the 1934 Act and the 1937 Act. The 1934 Act, when it originally was proposed by the Attorney General, would have covered all forms of taking. It would have covered robbery, burglary, and larceny, both with and without consent.
I suppose one explanation on the policy issue is that that's the way the Congress decided it should be.
But,
Your Honor, I don't
believe that that gives effect to what the 1937 Congress did.
No, my point is only with respect to the policy question that was suggested, that why does the federal government get into it? The answer is because Congress says. So.
Oh, that is precisely correct.
And provided you're reading the statute correctly. If
that's
they didn't
right.
say that, you'd make precisely the same argument to the contrary.
Well, our argument is simply that the plain language of the statute, if you put aside distinctions that are 200 and 300 years old and have been criticized for 200 or 300 years as just introducing technicalities into the law that have no equity, that if you read the plain language of the statute, it certainly covers the conduct of this petitioner, taking and carrying away $10,000. And then when you look at the legislative history of the 1937 Act, and what petitioner has done is to confuse the legislative history of the 34 Act with the legislative history of the 37 Act. There is no doubt that the 34 Act was limited to bank robberies, the house so limited. Their concern was the Bonnie and Clyde gangster bank robbers who moved around state to state.
Not just burglaries, but robberies.
Only robberies in 1934. In 1935, however, a significant fact occurred. Congress expanded the coverage of the bank robbery statute to cover not only Federal Reserve banks and banks chartered by the federal government, but in 1935, Congress expanded it to cover all banks insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, a much larger and greater area now of potential federal liability. So that in 1937, when the Attorney General went back to Congress, he asked the Congress to expand the coverage of the 1934 Act to include burglary and larceny, and he used new words to define larceny, not the old words that we used in 34, but new words, and the words that he used were taking and carrying away with intent to steal or purloin, so that the purpose of the 37 Congress cannot be the same as the limited purpose of the 34 Congress. The purpose of the 37 Congress goes beyond merely being concerned about taking by force and violence.
Mr. Giuliani, what if Mr. Bell, instead of being an outsider here, had been a teller in the Dade Federal Savings and Loan Association and had simply embezzled $10,000?
That would be covered by a separate statute
that had
an embezzlement, a federal embezzlement statute that applies to agents and employees of the bank, and that, in fact, had already been a violation of federal criminal law, I believe, at the time that these statutes were passed.
Would you say it was covered with also by this statute?
It could be covered by this statute as well.
Well, does that mean you think it might be, but you're not sure?
No, I believe that the purpose of the Congress in 1937 was to broadly prohibit theft from a federal bank.
So that
as that term was defined then as a generic
So the taking away requirement is really almost done away with, because in the facts of this case, you have Bell actually taking $10,000 that didn't belong to him, of dollar bills, so to speak, or tens or hundreds. But in the embezzlement thing, it's just basically a credit or a ledger transaction. But you say that's covered, too.
No. It doesn't have to be covered, Your Honor. You don't have to go that far, because at the time that this statute was passed, embezzlement was already a crime.
But I'm not trying to strike a bargain. I'm just trying to find out how you think the statute should be interpreted.
The statute should be interpreted to reach theft offenses, larceny by trick, and taking by false pretenses.
How about embezzlement?
It does not have to be read, and shouldn't be read to reach embezzlement. Embezzlement is already covered by another federal statute.
Do you think embezzlement is a taking away? At least there is a taking away here, isn't there?
Yes, Your Honor. It clearly is.
Would there be if there was an embezzlement, why wouldn't the statute cover it?
Well,
other instances where we've already recognized that I think it's in the bank field, where the same act violates two different criminal statutes.
You could interpret the statutes could cover the same ground. There is no doubt about it.
What about the false application on a loan application, a false statement on a loan application? That's covered in another section.
That's covered in 1014.
Was that on the books when this in 37?
I don't know if it was or not. If it was on the books in 37 or not, Your Honor. The embezzlement statute was a crime prior to 1934. I don't know about Section 1014. To assume that Congress in 1937 had reintroduced these distinctions would mean that it would be a violation of this statute if someone mistakenly received $1,000, as I said before, and decided to keep it. But it would not be a violation of this statute if he stole checks, forged those checks, presented those checks to a bank, and over a period of time depleted the bank of unlimited amounts of money, because at common law, one would constitute larceny by trick because there had only been a ceding of possession, and the other would constitute taking by false pretenses. Petitioner and the few circuits supporting his view in our view, confused the purpose of the 1934 Congress with the purpose of the 1937 Congress, and interpret those purposes as being exactly the same. The 1934 bill, as presented by the Attorney General and passed by the Senate, would originally have prohibited robbery, burglary, and larceny, defined actually as both taking by false pretenses and larceny at common law. The House Judiciary Committee struck the burglary and the larceny provisions, not, as petitioner would have it, because of some concern over the reach of common law larceny. There was no discussion of common law. There was no discussion of common law distinctions. The word never even came up in the legislative history. That Congress, the 1934 Congress, was concerned with limiting the crime to reach the situation of intrastate gangster bank robbers and wanted to limit the crime just to robbery and not to embrace burglary or any form of larceny. The 1937 Congress, when it took up this subject again, clearly had a different purpose than the 1934 Congress. The 1937 bill was intended to broaden coverage beyond robbery, beyond just merely taking by force and violence, to cover burglary and larceny. Conceitedly, under everyone's interpretation of this statute, it would cover crimes such as taking money mistakenly given by the bank, or larceny by trick, scarcely crimes that are committed by the Bonnie and Clyde interstate bank robbers. Once Congress removed the force and violence limitation and expanded the statute to reach nonviolent theft as well as fraudulent theft, it cannot be logical to ascribe to the 1937 Congress the same intent as the 1934 Congress. Rather, the more logical and sensible conclusion is that in expanding the statute, the intent of the 1937 Congress was to give broad protection to banks whose assets were insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Now, the choice of words that Congress used, I believe, is very important. The petitioner relies very heavily on the fact that Congress selected the words take and carry away and the title larceny, as if those two formulations are code words for all of the ancient distinctions of common law larceny. By 1937, however, the words take and carry away as well as the term larceny, no longer were limited solely to describing common law larceny. In fact, in the 1934 bill, which passed the Senate, it used the words take and carry away to go on and define takings without consent, which would have been common law larceny, and then taking and carrying away with consent, which at ancient common law would have been false pretenses. And as this Court has noted in the Turley decision, by 1919, the law of many states had developed to include not only common law larceny, but larceny by trick and false pretenses in their prohibition of generic larceny and theft offenses. This Court, in fact, in the Jerome case, twice used the label larceny for a description of crimes including false pretenses and pointed out that Congress did so in the legislative history to the 1934 Act. Thus, by 1937, to conclude mechanically and dogmatically that larceny means solely common law larceny and that takes and carries away means the same thing that it meant in the 18th century is to ignore the contemporary use of those words, both common use and use as words of art.
Mr. Giuliani, speaking of the Jerome case, in Jerome, the Court held the burglary prohibition of Section 2113A did not cover this act, and the underlying act in Jerome was, I think, uttering a forged check. Under your theory, could the government have brought that action under subsection B then?
Well, no, Your Honor, because actually it was an incomplete crime. The crime was never completed in Jerome in the sense of a taking and carrying away. The Jerome case does contain dicta.
That is contrary to
the position that the government is now arguing. At the same time, the Prince case contains dicta that supports precisely what the government is arguing. The Jerome case really involves, in our view, a very different issue. It involved the question of whether, in determining whether Congress meant to cover in the burglary section a situation where a person enters a bank with intent to commit a felony. Did Congress mean by felony under the laws of all the states, in which case what it would have read into the federal statute are the differing interpretations and definitions of felony, high misdemeanors, and misdemeanors that vary in the 48 states or not. It came to the conclusion, actually, which is supportive of our position, that you should not read felony to mean what felony meant at common law, and that you should give it an interpretation consistent with the purpose of the 1937 amendments, which is precisely
the act had been completed in the Jerome situation, could the government have prosecuted under subsection B?
Yes, I believe so. There had been actually a taking of the money.
Could the government, in the case that we had last term in Williams, have prosecuted for the check-kiting scheme under this subsection?
If the scheme had actually been completed in the sense that in check-kiting you have the ambiguity as to whether or not the person intends to make good on the check in the period of time between the time that they write the check and the time that the check is actually finally negotiated. If, in fact, the person goes through with the check-kiting scheme and takes away the money, then you really move out of the strict definition of check-kiting and you have a theft, an actual theft of the money. In looking at the language that was struck by the 1934 Act, the petitioner ignores several crucial points, and I think makes more of that than the legislative history can sustain. The 1934 Congress, as I said before, was concerned with the situation of robberies and limited the language to robberies. It was not in any way, didn't evince any concern at all with the coverage of larceny as either being common law larceny or false pretenses. So there was not a specific striking of the language because Congress was concerned with any of these distinctions as between common law larceny and false pretenses. And in 1937, the new language that was presented was significantly different. It deleted the words with consent of the bank, which would have covered false pretenses, but as Mr. Justice Stevens noted before, it also deleted the words without consent, which would have clearly defined solely common law larceny. So the words that it used, with intent to steal or purloin, in our view, created a or evinced a concern with a broad interpretation, or at least as broad as the matter that they were concerned about, the assets of federally insured banks.
To get back to the other question, if you may, what is there in the legislative history or the rules of the department that delineate a line between state and federal crime on a particular alleged crime?
Well, in this particular case, Your Honor, the line would be with this particular bank, a bank whose actual funds were insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
Well, you mean the state law wouldn't cover that?
No, state law does cover it. This is one of those.
Mine is what line says that this is a state crime and this is a federal crime?
In this particular case, it would be the federal interest in federally insured banks, the necessary and proper clause of the Constitution.
It was two crimes.
This is
two crimes, a federal crime and a state crime.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any procedure at the Department of Justice that says who should prosecute an instance of double crimes?
There isn't
a crime against two sovereigns.
There is a formal procedure that exists if a person is prosecuted in one place, and then the possibility of prosecuting him again because of the possible double jeopardy concerns involved in that. But there is no formal process that takes place in making that decision in advance. Most United States attorneys have policies that they work out with district attorneys as to what cases they will take and what cases would be turned over to the decline for local prosecution.
There's nothing in the record to show why this was brought into federal rather than the state court. In this one. There's nothing in this one.
No, Your Honor. In most urban areas, the local prosecutor is anxious for the federal government to take as many of these cases as the federal government can take because of the tremendous burden on the administration of justice. Yes, there is, Your Honor, but there's a sharing, there's a kind of an attempt to share the responsibility and to share the burden, and this would be one that would easily fall within a matter of federal interest. The amount of money was $10,000. It wasn't de minimis. In some of the drug cases, there are guidelines that are worked out so that it has to be either a conspiracy case or a case involving a certain amount of drugs for it to involve the federal government. And in some of the embezzlement cases, U.S. attorneys have dollar figures that they use to try to delineate the difference between whether the federal government will take the case or the state government. But by any standard that I know of, a theft of $10,000 would certainly be enough for a United States attorney to prosecute it anywhere.
If this savings and loan association had not been federally insured, could there have been a prosecution under this statute?
The statute was expanded in 1950, Your Honor, to cover additional institutions, and it is not limited just to institutions insured by the FDIC. There are a certain number of banks that aren't covered. I'm not exactly certain what the additional criteria would have to be. All banks.
But some savings and loan associations, I think, are purely state institutions.
That's correct.
Without any federal insurance. And I just wondered, on the face of the statute, any bank would seem to mean that you could answer that my
I think
question
that is,
yes, but I wondered.
I think that is further defined, Your Honor, to include only banks that are Federal Reserve banks, federally chartered banks, or banks that are insured by the federal government in some way. And there are very few banks left that.
Or any bank in the statute has been so limited?
I think it has been, yes, Your Honor.
Well, how has it been limited? It hasn't been limited by an amendment of the statute. has been a construction?
By a definition, somewhere, which?
Yes, further on in the statute, Your Honor, 2113F, as used in this section, the term bank means any member bank, Federal Reserve System, and any bank, banking association, trust company, savings bank, or other banking institution organized or operating under the laws of the United States, and any bank, the deposits of which are insured by the FDIC. So it would not be — there are very few banks left in that category.
Well, if that weren't the case, it would apply to any bank, and it wouldn't make any difference how this case came out. Whatever the reach of this statute, it would reach any bank.
That's correct. Yes. But subsection F limits that. Your Honor, there are four principal reasons why we urge this Court to affirm the decision of the Fifth Circuit. First of all, the plain language of this statute clearly reaches this conduct. Any ordinary person reading this statute would assume that this person's misconduct was covered by it. And there is no issue here of fair notice or in some way the petitioner is being treated unfairly because he might have misunderstood what the statute meant. Secondly, the legislative purpose evinced by the 1937 Congress clearly covers all forms of taking from a federally insured bank. That's exactly what happened here, and that interpretation, the government's interpretation, is in line with that purpose. Third,
may I interrupt right on that point? The footnote to your brief quotes, I guess it's a note, which I haven't read, but it points out that Chairman Sumners of the House Judiciary Committee in 1934 sought to limit the expansion of federal power just to those situations where there was really a strong showing of need. I'm curious to know if you, and I perhaps shouldn't take your time, but was he still chairman of the committee in 37?
I believe he was. I will check that, but I
but wouldn't
and
it
I
seem,
believe he introduced I believe he introduced the 37 legislation as well.
Well, that's why it would seem to me, I wonder if he thought it was as expansive as the government's argument would make. Is that consistent with the views he seemed to be espousing in 34? You think maybe he changed his mind?
Well, I actually don't think you have to say that in 37 you need an expansive interpretation of the language of either the statute or the legislative history, just a common-sense interpretation of it. The language, the plain meaning of the language clearly covers the misconduct, and the 37 Congress was clearly intending to protect banks, federally insured banks, broadly against theft. So I don't think they were
broadly than 34.
That's right.
Right, the only example that was given was a larceny example.
It was an example that would have constituted, if you used the common law distinctions, common law larceny. However, Your Honor, Chairman Sumners never displayed any interest at all or any concern about whether larceny was defined as common law larceny or taking by false pretenses. He was concerned about, in 34, limiting it just to robbery.
Right.
But in 34 or 37, there's absolutely no concern at all evidenced as to whether it should be common law larceny or larceny by false pretenses. In summation, the views have now been — this question has been passed on by just about every circuit. I believe 9 circuits have either held or expressed their viewpoint on this, and the split, for whatever it's worth, is 6-3 for the government's view. But also the most recent decisions, and I believe the best considered decisions, the Hinton case, which was decided after our brief in the Second Circuit, and the Simmons case, lay out the legislative history very clearly. Finally, to reintroduce these distinctions would just create unnecessary, needless distinctions that have no purpose any longer. It would become difficult to charge under this statute in the sense of bringing an indictment. It would be difficult to charge a jury as to the distinction between possession and title. It would also raise unnecessary issues on appeal that have nothing to do with the underlying equities of why theft or why protection of federally insured banks should be a federal crime. For all those reasons and for the others that we mentioned in our briefs, we ask this Court to affirm. Thank you very much.
Very well. Do you have anything further, Counsel?
Yes, I do, sir. May it please the Court, everything he says is true. The government is arguing
what the statute should say and maybe what the law should be, but I am arguing what the law is and what Congress intended the law to be specifically in the development of this law. This law has been specifically expanded and amended, and nowhere in all this time since 1934 has Congress taken upon itself to say it covers the crime of false pretenses. It's added larceny and burglary. The government used to argue in Jerome in 1943 it applied to common law larceny specifically. There's no question about that, but the definitions are not important. What we have to decide here is the ambiguity of steal and purloin. Is it expansive to the point where it covers crime by false pretenses? And the answer is no. Sumner specifically addressed that issue, saying he wanted to confine the extension of federal power to those situations where the need to supplement state and local law enforcing agencies had become imperative. It was an emergency type statute to eliminate bank robberies. It is the bank robbery statute, not the thing that is covered by state law, and the statute has not run on the state law in this case with regard to the fact that the man did commit a crime by false pretenses. That's my whole point in this case. 2113B is not an expansive statute. It is a narrowly defined and specifically drawn federal statute that does not approach and control black crime. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument.